Welcome once again. I am Jerry Usher, founder and president of ThirdMillenniumMedia.com. You will find us on the internet, and among the services and things that we provide are management of speakers for their media appearances and their speaking engagements. And one of the individuals we have partnered with is Adam Bly. He is a church-approved religious demonologist, trains priests to perform the ministry of exorcisms. He is employed full-time by the Diocese of Pittsburgh and, as I said, a church-decreed religious demonologist, and we are working our way through a series of questions and answers provided on the website of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. Last time we made our way through about the first half, and Adam, this time we're going to pick up with the second half of these and try and do them justice in the limited amount of time that we have. So,
okay.
You all set?
Sure.
All right. So, well, you know what? For those who may be seeing this for the first time, recap what it is that the bishops have done in posting mm-hmm. these questions and answers on their website.
Well, what the bishops have done, along with the final approval of the English translation of the New Rite of Exorcism, they have published 27 questions on their website in order to clarify some of the misunderstandings or misinformation that floats around in our culture, mostly based on the movies, so that people can learn about the truth about exorcism.
All right, and some of the questions we've dealt with already. What is an exorcism? Why does the church need them? Where is this in Scripture, the fathers of the church? How is it determined if someone is a candidate for an exorcism? Differences between the minor exorcism and major exorcism. And last time at the end, we talked about how does a priest become an exorcist? What criteria are used for deciding which priests are given this responsibility? And now we pick up with the question, how are exorcists trained and prepared for this ministry?
Mm-hmm. And the bishop's answer. Classically, the exorcist has trained for this specialized ministry through an apprenticeship model, working under the direction of an experienced exorcist. Additionally, in recent years, several programs have been established to foster the training of exorcists. A solid theological and spiritual foundation is essential when preparing to minister as an exorcist, bearing in mind the qualities already mentioned in the preceding question. The candidate must also maintain a balanced approach to this particular ministry, possess a spirituality that is grounded in the sacramental life of the church, and be able to keep his curiosity in check. The guidance of a skilled spiritual director is critical in the life of the exorcist. So, we see that the exorcist needs to be mentored. You need to learn from experience under somebody who has done this work before. It's not enough just to read books. We also see a reference to the various training programs that are available. There's about three in the world. There's Tulsa that's been going on for about 5 years where we've trained many priests. There's a number of programs at Mundelein in Chicago, both one for deliverance and exorcism, and the Pope Leo Institute that is just for priests. And there is the International Association of Exorcists in Rome that provides training at their meetings every 2 years.
All right, next the bishops post the question, what, if any, rites in this text may be performed by the lay faithful? And you can mention, of course, which text they're talking about.
Mm-hmm. So they're referencing here the text that has just been published, The New Rite of Exorcism, which is Exorcisms and Related Supplications. So they've changed the title a little bit from the old rite. So the bishop's answer. As has been mentioned previously, the rite of major exorcism is to be administered only by an authorized priest or bishop. If it is deemed useful, members of the lay faithful may be present for the rite, supporting the work of the exorcist by their prayers, either recited privately or as instructed in the rite. However, the text cautions that the lay faithful are not to recite any prayers reserved to the exorcist. Not only because the prayers are reserved to those ordained to act in persona Christi, the head, but also to protect the faithful from possible spiritual harm. When an afflicted member of the faithful is female, there should be at least one other female present for the sake of propriety and discretion. At no time should the exorcist be alone with an afflicted member of the faithful, neither during consultation nor the celebration of the rite. So there's a number of things in here. I think what the bishops are getting at, and it's something that has been argued to an extent or debated in some quarters, though I think it's clear. The lay faithful are not a priest. They're not speaking in the person of Christ, and they are not to directly address the demon. They are not to command the demon. That is the role of the priest appointed by the bishop. There are prayers where we may do the response to prayers, and we may pray privately for that person, which is a deprecatory prayer, just asking the grace of God to help that person.
We're working our way through a list of questions and answers posted on the website of the USCCB, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. It's usccb.org. With the increased influence of the demonic, the spiritual demonic and Satan, and the need for exorcism, the U.S. bishops have decided that they wanted to address this issue. And as we have learned, they have basically mandated that every diocese needs to have a protocol in place for assisting not only Catholics, but non-Catholic Christians, and even people of other faith traditions who may seek out the help if they believe that they are demonically possessed. And so with Adam Bly, we are working through this list of questions on the U.S. bishops' website. The next one, Adam, how does an exorcist determine, quote, with moral certitude, end quote, that the one to be exorcised is truly possessed by demonic forces and not merely suffering from physical ailments or psychological issues?
And the bishop's answer: moral certainty is classically understood as falling between the two poles of absolute certainty and probability. Bearing that in mind, moral certitude is achieved through the examination of proofs, which are weighed in accordance with the conscience of the one passing judgment. Therefore, the exorcist must utilize whatever resources are available to him when investigating a claim of demonic possession, along with input from medical and mental health professionals. The exorcist is instructed to employ the utmost circumspection and prudence before proceeding to the rite. Throughout his ministry, an exorcist must establish a balance within his own mind between not believing too easily that the devil is responsible for what is manifesting and attributing all possible manifestations solely to a natural organic source. So, in the old rite, they would spell out particular signs that one could look for, not all of which are going to be present in every case. Here, they are stepping back a little bit, and I think opening this up to the judgment of the priest that is trained and perhaps not sharing the specific signs that we look for in this public forum, though those traditionally are facility with all languages and languages the person doesn't know, knowledge of hidden things, the secret sins of people or events that the person was not at, detection of the holy, knowing whether something is blessed supernaturally, knowing and naming the relics of the saints that are in the room, maybe that the person is unaware of in supernatural strength, were the traditional ones, but they aren't all present in each case. And here I think they're just kind of saying there should be prudence and balance, that we not too readily find the devil, but we not too readily say he can't possibly be here.
Well, in a logical follow-up and related question, do afflicted members of the faithful undergo medical or psychological examination prior to the use of an exorcism?
And the bishop's answer: as part of the evaluation process, which can be established in a diocesan protocol, the afflicted member of the faithful should avail himself or herself of a thorough medical and psychological psychiatric evaluation. Frequently, individuals present themselves claiming to be afflicted in any number of ways. Historically, however, the Church has exercised caution when evaluating such individuals for fear of unnecessarily drawing attention to the machinations of the devil or giving credit where no credit is due. And so, historically, the Church has always required that a good medical workup, psychiatric, psychological workup be done to be sure that this isn't a misunderstanding, a psychosis from something, side effect of a medical problem like a brain tumor or hormone imbalance or other things. And I think that that's reasonable and prudent.
How may an exorcist ensure that an exorcism is not perceived as a magical or superstitious activity?
And the bishop's answer: the exorcist himself can serve as a catechist in this matter by the way he faithfully administers the rites provided by the Church in her wisdom. Fundamentally, the rites of exorcism are just one more way the Church tends to the pastoral care of souls, even souls that are not of her flock. However, the more obscurely and mysteriously the rite is portrayed, the more magical and superstitious the perception becomes. Given the superabundance of confusing and inaccurate information available in the public arena surrounding this particular topic, the manner in which this revised rite is announced provides for a teachable moment to believers and non-believers alike. And I think that's what we're trying to do here today. So basically, I think what they're saying here is that, you know, part of the process of exorcism, and this is something a lot of people don't understand, it's a pastoral process. It's not an exorcist comes in the room and says certain words and bam, it's over, as if he waved a magic wand. It's a pastoral process of the people understanding how they got entangled in this, renouncing things, confessing things, changing their lives, and then the prayers of that priest with the authority of the bishop behind them. And they're reinforcing what they've said earlier, that the church's ministry to care for souls that are afflicted in this way extends to non-Catholic Christians, even to non-believers, people of other faiths.
We are examining a series of questions and answers posted on the website of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. You'll find their website, by the way, online at usccb.org. And this series of questions has to do with the ministry of exorcism in the church. The church has recently revised the rite of exorcism for the first time since the early 17th century, and there seems to be a heightened and increasing awareness and attention being given to the activity of the demonic, the spiritual realm, and even maybe an increasing need of training of priests in exorcisms. That's one of the things that Adam Bly does, who is with us here. We're examining these questions with his expert help here. The next question, Adam, what ritual symbols are used in exorcisms and what do they symbolize?
And the bishop's answer, in addition to the use of the psalms and gospel readings and the recitation of the exorcistic prayers, a series of sacred symbols is utilized in the rite of major exorcism. To begin, water is blessed and sprinkled, recalling the centrality of the new life the afflicted person received in baptism, and the ultimate defeat of the devil through the salvific work of Jesus Christ. The imposition of hands, as well as the breathing on the person's face, exhalations, by the exorcist reaffirms the power of the Holy Spirit at work in the person as a result of his or her baptism, confirming him or her as a temple of God. Finally, the Lord's cross is shown to the afflicted person, and the sign of the cross is made over him or her, demonstrating the power of Christ over the devil. I think this one is pretty clear. There's a strong tradition in the church going way back of using the psalms. As things developed, the gospels, particular stories, remind the demon of its station, remind the demon of its defeat, of its status, you know, as a subject of Christ the King. The devil is the prince of this world, but there's only one king. So I think this one's pretty clear.
Next question posed by the bishops, which they do answer, should other members of the faithful be present when an exorcism is performed?
Mm-hmm. The bishops answer, this text strongly recommends against the exorcist working in isolation. Even though in rare instances this may be unavoidable, the practice of performing an exorcism in solitude should be discouraged at all costs. And that's true. Demons are tricky. Things can get violent. But also, demons aren't above making accusations or trying to set somebody up through setting up an environment in a room. Other members of the faithful can, I think this can also lead into the idea, should other people be allowed to just come and watch? And I don't think anybody should be there out of curiosity. If you're there out of curiosity, you're there for selfish reasons. If you're going to be in an exorcism, it should be an act of charity and love done in obedience to help that soul and not about yourself.
Adam, next, where should an exorcism be performed?
And the bishop's answer, the norm is to celebrate the rite of exorcism in an oratory or other appropriate place, for example, a small chapel, discreetly hidden from plain view. It is to the advantage of the exorcist whenever possible to utilize a place that is dedicated to God's honor and not the home of the afflicted person, for instance. So it's certainly an advantage to do this work in a chapel near the Blessed Sacrament, having the relics of the saints present, having it be a very sacred place that's blessed, both by blessings and the use of that place. We really want to bring the possessed onto to our turf, so to speak, get as much of the spiritual pressure on our side as possible and as much of that advantage.
The United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, not too long ago, put out a series of questions and answers on the Church's Ministry of Exorcism, and they posted some frequently asked questions on their website. That is what we are examining here now with the help of expert religious demonologist Adam Bly, Church Decree demonologist, by the way, by the decree of Bishop Zubik of the Diocese of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And the next question is, the use of exorcism kept confidential?
And the bishop's answer: for the integrity of the afflicted person's reputation, as well as for those individuals who might be assisting, the preservation of confidentiality is important. It is also strongly suggested that the identity of the exorcist be kept secret, or at most known only to other priests of the diocese, so as not to overwhelm the exorcist with random calls and inquiries. So I think both of these are important. It's very important to protect the dignity of the family. Imagine if you had a family member that unfortunately was going through a possession and having exorcisms done, and the media got a hold of that, or somebody put it on their website and bragged about how they were there, or snuck a recorder into the room and recorded some of the audio and posted it online. Not only would this, you know, be hurtful to the family, but it could lead to the reporter being on the front stoop the next morning trying to do some sensationalistic story. These situations being exposed, depending on how the person gets attention, can ruin a family's life. And so we try to be very respectful of people's dignity and protect their dignity. We don't record exorcisms. We don't allow the media to tag along and record or follow us on cases. I think that's very important.
Next question: may an exorcism be performed without the recipient's permission?
Mm-hmm. And the bishop's answer: given the nature of the devil's workings and the afflicted person's possible complicity in the resulting demonic possession, the exorcist should ascertain the person's consent, if at all possible, before proceeding with the rite of major exorcism. It's an interesting one. So we do want to have some act of the free will. We want to know that the person wants to be free. Without the free will desiring to be free and to turn away from the devil, we can't exorcise the person. God doesn't violate our free will. If a person is a Satanist and they want to be possessed and they're wallowing in it and enjoying it, you can't exorcise them because they have authority over their body and their life. So we want to see a sign of that. Now, some people, their possession is so dire and the impairment is so great, the dominion over their body is so great, that they may not be able to speak to the priest without being choked, without having their voice cut off. And so they may only be able to manage a nod when the priest says, "Do you want help? Do you want to be free?" Something like that. So, you know, I think they're letting us know here, we want to find some consent before moving on.
The next question posted on the website of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops regarding the Church's rite of exorcism is, are exorcisms the same everywhere, or are there regional and cultural differences?
And the bishop's answer: the rites of exorcism are to be celebrated consistently following the directives, the praenotandra, prescribed in the ritual. The rites are not to be altered at the discretion of the exorcist beyond the options clearly stated in the official text. However, before proceeding with the use of this rite, it is helpful for the exorcist to be aware of any cultural differences and regional influences that may have impacted the current state of the afflicted person. An evaluative instrument can assist in shedding light on such categories as the places where the person may have visited, like healers, mediums, psychics, these types of things, the practice in which the person may have been involved, cleansing, New Age religion, Reiki, or three, the ways the person may have opened himself or herself directly to the dominion of the devil, magic, witchcraft, satanic worship. So I think what they're saying here is the rite. It's the same everywhere. We use it the same everywhere. But we explore the particular context of that person when we want to understand how they became possessed. So the rite's going to be the same, but we want to know how the devil got in. And so we want to help the person close those doors, because we have to close off the doors and renounce the legal rights that were given to the demon to be there before exercising it.
All right, well, a few more questions here to work our way through on this presentation from the U.S. bishops on their website, questions which they also post the answers to. In the formulas of exorcism, what is the difference between the deprecative formulas and the imperative formulas?
This is actually a critical question, though most people haven't heard of these words before. And the bishops answer. The deprecative formulas are exorcistic prayers addressed to God, which request the liberation of the afflicted person. The imperative formulas are addressed directly to the inhabiting demonic spirit, commanding it to depart in the name of Jesus Christ. This is one of the most important points for people to understand. It sounds obscure, but it's critically important. Essentially, deprecatory prayer is a request to God. Oh God, please help this person. Okay? It's a prayer sent up. Imperative formula is a direct command, and it invites a struggle. It's a conflict, and that is reserved to the priest exorcist. This is where some of the differences between deliverance work and exorcism can come in. And this is the sticking point for some of the arguments that go on in the world between these two. Deliverance, in my opinion, should be deprecatory. It should be a request, because imprecatory is a direct command or a conflict with that demon. And when people use a direct command outside of the context of an exorcism with all that authority behind them in persona Christi as a priest, they're inviting a direct struggle with the demon without all that backing. And we have seen cases of possession that have resulted from that.
And you're going to address next time the difference between deliverance ministry and exorcism as performed officially by the church. Well, the next question the bishops pose is, when would each of these types be used?
And the bishops answer. The deprecative formulas and the imperative formulas are presented as sets in the ritual of exorcism, with the deprecative formula always being used first, with the option of then using the imprecative formula. The deprecative formulas may be used without the imperative formulas, but the opposite is not permitted. So basically, they would start with the deprecatory prayers. In the old days, sometimes we would use prayers like that in order to help us diagnose a case, because those prayers will often agitate the demon enough to manifest and show the signs of possession, and we would only move on to the imperative form in an exorcism when we had moral certainty that a possession was happening. And there's hints of that here in the new ritual also.
All right, we are close to finishing our examination of the list of questions and answers posted on the USCCB website regarding the Ministry of Exorcism. They're called Frequently Asked Questions, usccb.org. Two more left. When would the rites contained in the appendices be used and by whom?
And the bishops answer. The prayers of supplication and exorcism found in Appendix 1, a supplication and exorcism which may be used in particular circumstances of the church, may be likened to the prayers that Pope Leo XIII appended to the previous rite of exorcism in 1890. The focus of these prayers is to address and remedy any demonic influence on places and things in particular, as well as to remedy attacks against the church in a more general way. As in the case of a major exorcism, the ordinary minister of these prayers would be a priest appointed for this purpose, or the bishop himself. The prayers and invocations that comprise Appendix 2, supplications which may be used by the faithful privately in their struggle against the power of darkness, are intended for general use of the clergy and of the lay faithful in combating temptations of sin or spiritual attacks by the devil. The only comment I would make here, as we've said before, I think it's pretty clear that they mean in themselves for self-defense as opposed to praying over other people.
Final question, when would a bishop or pastor appropriately recommend Appendix 2 to a member of his flock?
And the bishops answer, when it is learned through such avenues as pastoral counseling, spiritual direction, or the sacrament of penance that a member of the faithful is experiencing assaults by the devil, the prayers and invocations found in Appendix 2 may be recommended. The Committee on Divine Worship intends to make Appendix 2 available as a separate publication once the English texts have been approved by the Holy See. So I think we have additional guidance here, and we can look forward to that publication for the lay faithful hopefully soon.
Very good. Well, coming up in the remainder of this series, Adam, you're going to be dealing with a lot of these issues and a whole lot more. I think it's going to be very informative for people.
I hope so. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
If you want more information on Adam and his ministry, you can find that at religiousdemonology.com. And we encourage you to visit our website, thirdmillenniummedia.com, where Adam and many other speakers are represented, and you will find additional information about Adam and his ministry there, thirdmillenniummedia.com.